We're ready for argument now in the case of Wallace against McLaughlin. Mr. O'Neill.
May it please the court, Mr. Hunt. My name is Michael O'Neill, and together with my colleague Kelly McFadden, we represent the defendant and appellant in this matter, Jonathan McLaughlin, M.D. This appeal of a jury verdict in a medical malpractice case involves or presents the question of did the plaintiff present sufficient evidence to this jury upon which the plaintiff could prove the element of proximate cause. Now, I
gather there's no current dispute about the size of the damages.
That is correct, Your Honor. While we did have
$700,000 award for the loss of night vision seems high. For that amount, you could hire a Rolls and a chauffeur to drive you around at night for life, and then some.
Well, perhaps unless you'd invested that money in an account with AIG or some other insurer or stockbroker, but in any event, Your Honor, I'm a trial lawyer, and in preparing this appeal, I asked some of my colleagues at my firm for some advice about a, quote, sufficiency of the evidence appeal, and the advice I received, frankly, was you lose if you argue the facts, and you win if you argue the law. And in this case, I think it's quite unique in that I think it's quite my colleague is wrong on both counts. I think here, when you look
at sometimes you win if you argue the facts and you lose if you argue the law.
Well, I think here what's important for all of us to
lose.
What's important for all of us to keep in mind here, Your Honors, I think we win both ways. I think if you take a look at the facts as they were presented and in context of the standard of review, which is whether there was sufficient evidence to sustain this verdict or not, the question is certainly or not, because there was just not enough evidence because of the law that applies in a medical malpractice case. In Indiana, applying substantive Indiana law of medical malpractice, the plaintiff, in order to prove the causation and the damages, is required by law to come forward with expert testimony. And that's where the plaintiffs lose here as a matter of law. And they lose for a couple of reasons. They lose primarily because of the issue of permanency. Your Honor mentioned the $700,000 or so verdict, and I agree that that is a substantial amount of money for the injury we're talking about. But the question begged by this case and by the evidence presented by this case was, did Mrs. Wallace have a permanent injury, or did she have something less than that, an injury like a broken arm or some other type of personal injury that a plaintiff in a claim against a tortfeasor might assert, but the injury heals. The injury gets better. In this case involving a LASIK surgery on both eyes, on the right eye and the left eye, and as the court, I believe, is aware, the eye at issue in this case was the left eye only. A very small layer of cells is taken off the top of the eye as part of this procedure with literally a razor blade instrument. Those cells are peeled back or peeled away, and a flap is supposed to remain a hinge, if you will, on that flap of tissue of epithelial cells, and then the laser is applied to the cornea, to the next layers of the cornea, to redirect and reshape the corneal surface, and then that small flap that was removed is replaced.
How long was the time from the date of the surgery until the trial of the case?
The surgery was on April 25th of 2002, and trial took place in October of 2007, so about 5.5 years from the time of surgery, or the time of the surgery until the time of trial.
And Tracy Wallace was examined by, her physician, or doctor?
Yes, Your Honor. After she had the surgery by my client, Dr. McLaughlin.
But was there an examination very close to the time of trial?
There was an examination by Dr. Connor, the optometrist, a week or two before trial, and that became the subject of a debate with the district court judge. And the court, in that instance, agreed with me that evidence relating to that last visit, because there had been about a 2.5-year gap between the last time this patient was seen by Dr. Connor, her optometrist, and the time of trial, And the district court, Judge McKinney, agreed that evidence relating to that visit and the records relating to that visit, because a bunch of additional testing that had never been done before was done, and that for those reasons, that information about that visit were not going to be heard by the jury, and was that information was not presented to the jury.
Is there any evidence much later after the surgery that was admitted with regard to the condition of the left eye?
All we had, sadly, I would suggest for the plaintiff here, was a discovery deposition of Dr. Price. Now, Dr. Francis Price is a quite renowned ophthalmologist here in Indianapolis. This patient was referred to him days after the surgery by Dr. McLaughlin to take a look and see whether there was anything he could do to repair these buttonhole flap complications that occurred in both eyes. And Dr. Price then undertook to treat this patient. He did two surgeries, and surgery is really quite an overstatement. They were two, you know, very subtle procedures to try to smooth out, if you will, you'll imagine this outer layer as being like a piece of saran wrap, and sometimes you put the saran wrap and try to rewrap it, and it has crinkles in it. So there were two procedures done, one almost immediately in June of 2002, and another in July of 2003 by Dr. Price to the subject left eye to smooth out these wrinkles that were left as a product of this surgery by my client, by Dr. McLaughlin.
What I was getting at, did Dr. Price then see her again closer to the trial date?
The last time Dr. Price saw the patient was in July of 2006. There had been a period of just over a year that the patient had not seen Dr. Price, and like the situation with Dr. Connor and this patient being sent to see Dr. Connor just before trial, she was sent to see Dr. Price a couple of days before his discovery deposition was taken so that he could have some more timely information, some perhaps more timely ability to testify and to give opinion testimony regarding what he saw on this examination. And that's precisely the point, Your Honor, of the or of my initial statement about how they lose on the facts here, too.
Well, that's what I was getting to. Is there any way that the jury could infer that it hadn't improved or improved little over that period of time to make that a permanent condition?
This court has to look at the record de novo, of course, and determine whether there's substantial evidence or not. And of course, a mere scintilla of evidence is not enough. Mr. Hunt and I, in our briefs, as well as in our arguments with the court, with the district court on this issue, have very different views, I would suggest, on what it is Dr. Price actually said. What we do know, he said, the last time he saw this patient, both in his deposition testimony as well as in his typewritten record that's part of the record on appeal here, is that he could see no reason why Tracy would be having any problems with respect to her left eye, that he looked at it. The slit lamp examination is literally a microscope that you put up and look at the eye and go across from one end to the other, looking at it in a very narrow fashion. And his slit lamp examination of the left eye showed an eye that had returned to just about normal. Now, the right eye, he saw some problems and recommended the patient come back for some further evaluation, which she never did, either before trial or, to my knowledge, since. Now, therein lies the problem with respect to Dr. Price, who is the only expert offering any sort of testimony for the jury to hang an award in favor of the plaintiff upon. They need experts. They brought in Dr. Price, actually read his discovery, their portions of his discovery deposition, and all he says is the left eye looked okay, right eye had some problems. Come back after you've taken your contact lenses out, because what he did see in his final examination of this patient were contact lenses that were being worn for 12 to 15 hours per day, that were gunked up, that were scratched, and in his records he notes that that's very likely the reason why she's having some problems with her vision, or some ongoing problems with her visions. That's just not enough in terms of the type and kind of evidence, expert evidence, that a plaintiff needs to bring to bear in order to have a jury give an award for permanent damages. Now, the other issue, the other question, of course, that arises occurred just during trial, and that's the issue of the pre-existing condition. Now, again, Mr. Hunt and I have some, I think, very different views about what Mrs. Wallace said and when she said it. But I think the record, if you look at it carefully and review it carefully, is indisputable. She, under Rule 26, had an obligation to tell us about a pre-existing condition automatically without being asked, and we weren't told. Interrogatories were sent where the question was posed regarding whether or not there were any previous injuries or damages or problems with her eyes, to which she answered no. Her discovery deposition then was taken, and in her discovery deposition, there are a series of four questions, all of which delve with the issue of whether there were any problems that pre-existed the condition that she was suing for, and each of those questions were answered in the negative, were answered no. Then lastly, and I think critically, at trial, under cross-examination, after Mr. Hunt asked her questions about her ongoing problems, the halos, the glare, and the difficulty driving at night, those are really the three ways that this injury she was seeking damages for manifest itself, she says under cross-examination that these problems with her eyes all started after the surgery Dr. McLaughlin performed.
When you did that cross-examination, weren't you using that intake report that Dr. Connor had?
That's what we had flashed up after asking the initial questions, after confirming that these were the three complaints she had, the glare, the halos, and the difficulties with night vision.
So you had that report at trial. You had it long before trial.
Yes.
And the information on it is what you used to cross-examine her.
Correct. And here's the problem that the plaintiff faced. And I'm not giving advice to the plaintiff. I'm not in terms of how to testify, other than I imagine she was advised to tell the truth. But what happened at trial is her husband took the stand, and then she took the stand. And in both of those examinations, this period of time from the surgery on April 25th until she went to see Dr. Connor for a second opinion on the 29th, this four-day period was described as a period. And again, this is all new testimony, not anything that was elicited in her discovery deposition. But it was a four-day period where the patient, I would say in an exercise of overreaching, described a situation where she was home with the blinds drawn, with dark glasses on, could not see, could not go anywhere, any bit of light shining, even a television, unable to watch television. This is all in the record, that she was having all of these problems for those 4 days and couldn't do anything, couldn't go anywhere, couldn't stand the idea of even light touching on her eyes. That's the record that was set by Mr. Wallace first and then Mrs. Wallace. And it's in that context, after I affirmed initially in my cross-examination that it was her testimony and her position that all of these problems started after the surgery, that I asked her the critical questions, well, ma'am, can you explain to me how it is that if you were in a room for 4 days with the blinds drawn and the lights off and no television on because of the nature and the extent of this injury, how is it that you knew? And then we flashed up on the screen the report, the history form she filled out on the 29th with Dr. Connor, indicating that she had problems with halos, with glare, with difficulty driving at night.
So if you had that report, it wasn't news to you at trial that she had made that report to Dr. Connor?
No, the implication,
which you inferred related to her pre-surgery problems.
Exactly, and that's why in her discovery interrogatories, as well as in her discovery deposition, those questions were asked in order to determine, in order to elicit information. And, of course, it would be a much different case, in a case where I wouldn't be able to stand here and say there was insufficient evidence to connect up the surgery to any damages, permanent or otherwise. I wouldn't be able to stand here and say that had we known about the pre-existing condition, because the discovery deposition of Dr. Price, we then could have delved into with him what his views were on how her eyes were in comparison to the way they were before her surgery.
So my concern about this argument is very similar to that of my colleague. When you say you didn't know about this pre-existing condition, you had her own self-report of having a problem with night vision. What is it that you didn't know? It's true that the plaintiff didn't confess in a way that she was making things up, and it's your view that she should have, but we don't run a legal system in which no trial is perfect unless the other side confesses that it's exaggerating.
It's for this reason, Your Honor. It's because she did just the opposite. In her discovery deposition, the opportunity for discovery for us to learn what this case is about, she was asked, quote, did you ever have problems with vision glare before you got operated on? No. Did you ever have any problems with halos before you got operated on the eyes? No.
And all the while, you were sitting on that report, waiting to spring it on her at trial in a blow-up so the jurors could see it at the same time. Yeah. Didn't you make a strategic choice along the way that you had a gotcha?
Well, The plaintiff was going to have to stake out her position, and the position she staked out, and the only information we had to give to Dr. John, our independent medical examiner, our expert, the only information we had in order to cross-examine Dr. Price or at trial Dr. Connor, was the information she gave us in her discovery responses. We had a piece of paper.
You didn't have Connor's intake.
No, we had that, Your Honor. The information on that form, the implication from that form, at least in my view, was that this is information that she was reporting regarding these 4 days leading up to the time she came to see Dr. Connor.
Well, let's talk about the law a little bit.
Sure.
Indiana has pattern jury instructions.
Correct.
And you submitted some of those pattern jury instructions at the instructions conference or in preparation for that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Indiana's got a pattern jury instruction on aggravation of a preexisting injury, doesn't it?
We most certainly do, Your Honor.
Did you object to the court's instructions?
There was no instruction submitted by either the plaintiff or by the defense regarding the issue of a preexisting condition. And here's why. It's my understanding of the law that you can't, as a party on appeal, invite error. In order to have an instruction can properly be given, the legal instruction, must be supported by the evidence. Here there was no evidence. In other words, let's assume for purposes of argument.
The intake thing, didn't that support an instruction with regard to mitigation of the damages?
Not in terms of what's material here, which is the expert testimony. Neither of these experts, Dr. Connor, if we can call him an expert, and I'll concede he's got something expert-wise I suppose he can offer, but more importantly, Dr. Price, neither one of those physicians knew about this pre-existing condition, had any information about this pre-existing condition, and in terms of the burden of proof, that's where the proof has to come from. And it couldn't have been there because it was tainted by virtue of the fact that they didn't have information from the patient, self-report or copies of Dr. Connor's records, if you want to call that information about a pre-existing condition. But in any event, with regard to the issue of the instruction, I think to have tendered that instruction would have been inviting error.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you.
Mr. Hunt.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Robert Hunt. I'm representing the Wallaces. I'd like to begin by addressing something that came out in the reply brief that I've not had a chance to talk about, obviously, because it was only in the reply brief, and that is the issue of the waiver of the entire issue of the pre-existing condition. Mr. O'Neill, in his reply brief, said that we had waived the waiver because we didn't object to the Rule 50B motion. If the court will examine in the record the actual language that was that motion consisted of, the court will see that Mr. O'Neill never asked the court in its 50B motion to grant a judgment on the basis of pre-existing condition. There's no question he, in the argument section of his post-trial brief dealing with the Rule 50B motion, he talked about pre-existing condition. But every time he stated what he was asking the court to do, he said repeatedly, we are asking the court, we are renewing our motion on the basis of the issue of permanency, over and over and over again. So in that Rule 50B motion, there was nothing for us to object to because he never asked the court below to make a ruling on the issue of pre-existing condition in the context of the Rule 50 motion. He did in the context of the Rule 59 and 60 motions, which are not on appeal to this court, but he did not do that there. So the argument that we somehow waived that right to now point out to this court that he has waived the argument simply doesn't follow because that Rule 50 motion was never made on the 50B motion was never made on the basis of a claim of a pre-existing condition. The real issue that's before the court and which was procedurally proper is whether the Rule 50B motion on the issue of permanency was appropriate. We certainly agree, say that it was not appropriate. The court should the district court was correct in denying that motion because, as we pointed out in our brief, there were three doctors who testified at the trial on the issue of permanency. Even Dr. John, who was their own examining physician, Dr. McLaughlin's own examining physician, stated that he did not believe that Tracy Wallace's condition was going to get any better. Even in the questioning that was made by Mr. O'Neill in the cross-examination of Dr. Connor, he specifically said, now, Dr. Connor, you've testified that, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, Dr. Connor, you've testified that Tracy Wallace is not going to improve. And he said, yes, that's my testimony. Mr. O'Neill recognized when asking that question that there was evidence of permanency that had been produced in the form of Dr. Connor's testimony. In the initial opening brief filed by Dr. McLaughlin, he says there was no evidence, no expert evidence on the issue of permanency. When that was pointed out to him in my response brief, in the appellee's brief, in the reply brief, he backs off of that, and he starts to challenge whether Dr. Connor was truly an expert qualified
counsel,
to render that
counsel,
type of opinion.
Maybe I'm just misunderstanding what the defendant's argument is, but although there seems to be some language back and forth about permanence, I'd understood the defendant's argument as concerning causation. That whatever condition it was that was permanent, whatever condition it was as of the last exam in July 2006, was not capable of causing the asserted injury. That given Dr. Price's findings as of July 2006, there's no explanation for a loss of night vision or any similar problem. Unless, of course, it was a pre-existing condition, and then it wouldn't be compensable. That's what I understood them to be arguing, all the verbiage about permanence one way or the other. Is that something that you think they're arguing? Because if you don't think they're arguing it, assume they're arguing it.
Your Honor,
and address it.
Your Honor, I don't agree that it was a causation argument. I don't think they made a causation argument. I agree. It's confusing because it's going all over the place when we were
doing it. Then humor me.
Okay.
And treat it as if it were a causation argument.
Okay.
What would you say if it were a causation argument?
If it were a causation argument and he had raised it at trial in the Rule 50 motion, 50A motion, I would have done exactly what the case law talks about should be done in that situation. I would have considered his argument and decided whether I should request the opportunity to present additional evidence on that subject of causation. But because the defendant didn't, the appellee did not raise that, we never had that opportunity. We never got there. Keep in mind that there were no objections whatsoever to any of the expert testimony by Dr. McLaughlin. None. None to their qualifications, none to their what they had to say. No instructions were given challenging anything. As the court has pointed out, it was very important that if they perceived that this was a pre-existing condition, they would have tendered an instruction talking about it.
Okay. Let me come back and be sure I understand your answer. You're saying that if this were a causation argument, mm-hmm. hypothetically, your hypothetical answer would simply be that it hasn't been preserved. Would you have any argument on the merits?
Judge, I don't think there was any question that the arguments that the evidence was presented by all three doctors was that it was caused by this. In other words,
I certainly understood, at least to the extent I've been through this and understand what people were saying, that Price was saying that as of July 2006, the condition in the plaintiff's left eye was not one that would have caused a problem with bad night vision, for example.
Judge, I don't think that's what Dr. Price's evidence says. I respectfully disagree with that interpretation because I don't think that's what he says.
Well, that's the other part of your hypothetical answer.
Right.
You're saying A, the argument wasn't preserved, and B, Price's testimony actually supports causation.
Right. Okay. And as you'll note in the record, even Judge McKinney, when ruling on the Rule 50 motion, talked about the reasonable inferences that could be drawn from Dr. Price's testimony about the permanency.
That's what we'll have to do. If this hypothetical argument was non-hypothetically preserved, we'll have to see what the real Dr. Price actually said.
Your Honor, I don't think I have anything further out. Unless the Court has any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them.
It doesn't look like it, Counsel.
Thank you.
In that event, thank you very much. The case is under advisement.